talk this evening, I was planning to talk about the topic of confidence, and I don't mean confidence in the sense of feeling, you know, like self-confident or anything like that. I mean confidence in the Buddhist sense of saddha, like confidence in the Buddha's teaching, confidence in the Buddha and in the Dhamma, basically. And the reason I want to talk about this is because I was recently involved in a discussion with some people who were not really Buddhist, or that some of them were Buddhist, some of them were non-Buddhist, some of them were almost anti-Buddhist. But they all knew a lot about Buddhism. They had a lot of understanding of the Buddha's teachings. And it was interesting because I consider myself also to know a fair bit about Buddhism. So it was fascinating. Here I was arguing with somebody who knew roughly what I know about Buddhism, and yet they had no confidence, whereas I had a lot of confidence in these teachings. And it sort of became very clear to me that there is a big distinction here. Knowledge is not enough. Why is it that some people have confidence and other people don't? What is this thing we call confidence, this thing called saddha? What does it actually mean? And how does it arise? Why is it that some people get it, whereas other people don't? What is going on here? And so it's not enough to know about these teachings. What I thought I would do is to tell you a story from the suttas. This is like the preeminent story in the suttas about a man who was considered to be the preeminent disciple of the Buddha in terms of confidence. He had very powerful confidence in the teachings. And I thought, if we look at what he did and how he gave rise to this sense of confidence, I don't like the word faith. I think confidence is much more appropriate. And I want to show you why confidence is more appropriate rather than faith through looking at this particular story. Now, this story is a young man known as Ratthapala in the suttas, and he was later on proclaimed that foremost of the disciples in confidence. And he lived in a small town in India, and he came from a very wealthy family. His family had lots of big house and lots of wealth. And he was, I'm not sure exactly how old he was. He probably was maybe around 20 or perhaps in his early 20s. He already had a couple of wives at this time. In those days, it was common for wealthy families for men in wealthy families to have several wives. And he already had a couple of wives. And the family he came from was a very kind of upper family. It was like a high-class family as well. So he had everything in life, everything that people usually strive for in the world, he had. And then one day, while he was living his ordinary life, the Buddha comes to the town where he's living here. And when the Buddha comes to the town when somebody is living here, because the Buddha was already very famous at this stage, usually his reputation sort of precedes him as he travels around. And everybody starts saying to each other, there is this man called Gautama who has arrived. And this amazing reputation about this man Gautama is being spread around. So let's all go and see what this Gautama man is all about. It's wonderful. It's useful to see people with such a good reputation. So India has always been a very spiritual country. Even today, if you go to India, you see all the sadhus and all the religious people wandering around. And it was exactly the same at the time of the Buddha. When somebody with a good reputation came to town, people wanted to go and see, what is this? Is there something profound going on here? Something useful? Something that we can make use of in our lives. So what happened then was that most of the inhabitants of this little town, they went together, and Ratthapala, this young man from the good and wealthy family, he went together with all the people of this town, and they went out to see the Buddha. And they sit down, and then the Buddha gives them a talk. And when the Buddha speaks, he always inspires people. He rouses them. He makes people feel that there's something powerful and wonderful there. And then when people are roused and inspired, then they go back to the town and they have had some kind of infusion in their life, something to make their life more meaningful. And this is how the reputation precedes the Buddha. Now this Ratthapala, after having heard the talk of the Buddha, he doesn't go back with everybody else. Rather, what Ratthapala does, he then goes up to the Buddha and he says, Venerable Sir, I've been listening to your teaching. And as I understand your teaching, the right thing to do for me is to go forth into homelessness, to leave the home life behind. Why? Because it's very difficult to live the spiritual life fully and completely if you live the home life. Now that already is quite, it's interesting in one sense, because it shows you that the ideal at the time of the Buddha, and that is also still the ideal today in Buddhism, is actually to go forth from the home life. If you want to live the spiritual life fully, basically it is the monastic life that is the full living of the spiritual life. That is what he's saying here, because ordinary life usually is too busy and there's too many other things happening to really be able to live it fully. And then the Buddha replies, have you got your parents' permission? Because this was required in those days, because parents had a lot of say over their children. And he said, no, I haven't. Well, you first have to get that before I can give you the ordination. And then Ratapala says, okay, I will see to it that my parents give me permission to go forth into homelessness. And then he goes back to his parents and he says, dear mother and father, please allow me to go forth into homelessness. And the parents say, no way. That's essentially what they say. Just like parents today, nothing has changed in 2,500 years. When I wanted to go forth and become a monk, my parents were absolutely shocked, just like many parents are today. So that's all the same. So parents said, no way, you are our dear and beloved son. You have been raised in comfort, raised in happiness, surrounded by pleasure. You don't know anything about suffering. You should stay in the household life. We do not permit you to go forth. But Ratapala is very determined. He really, really wants to go forth. So he asked his parents a second time and a third time. Usually things are done in threes according to the old suttas. And then his parents continue to refuse. They say, you are only son. You are the heir apparent. Particularly in India, certainly in those days, they would have an heir. And this heir was very important because he would bring the family forward into the next generation. So then Ratapala, he's so determined that he lies down on the floor right there and says to his parents, right, either I'm going to be allowed to go forth, or I'm going to lie here and until I die. That's what he says. And very determined, very powerful. You know, the fascinating thing here, how is it that somebody can have so much faith, or rather confidence, that they're willing to do this? This is the point behind this story. And then he lies there, and his parents, they continue to to try to tell him, you know, please come back, don't be foolish, you can't just lie there and die. What a waste of a life. They get his friends to try to persuade him to come back to the ordinary life. But he's so determined, and after a number of days, 6 or 7 days, been lying on the floor, he's getting very weak at this stage. His parents realize that, well, either he's actually going to die, or we allow him to go forth. And of course, then they say, well, okay, because you're going to die, there's not much point for you just dying on the floor, so we allow you to go forth, but if later on when you have gone forth, please come back and visit us afterwards. So they eventually allow him to go forth. And then Ratapala, he gets up, he eats again, drinks, regains his strength after all the days of hunger strike. This must have been one of the first cases of hunger strike in world history, I think. Essentially a hunger strike. And he regains his strength after his little hunger strike. And then he goes off to the Buddha and says, my parents have given me the permission. Please allow me to go forth and to become a monk in your dispensation. And then the Buddha ordains him. And then he follows the Buddha around to Savatthi, one of the major cities in Buddha at the time, a city which you can still see today if you go to India. And then shortly afterwards, which usually means a few years afterwards, he then attains full awakening according to this sutta. But the amazing thing, what is so powerful about this story, I find it such a beautiful story, so inspiring to read somebody who has so much confidence. But where does it come from? Why is it? How can it be that somebody has such incredible confidence in these teachings? Why is that? And that is the interesting point here. How can it happen? And the reason why it happens, if you remember the story, all Ratapala did was go to the Buddha and see him and listening to the talk. And what the confidence actually comes from just that. It comes from seeing somebody who is very, very extraordinary. When you see somebody like the Buddha, it doesn't have to be the Buddha. It can be somebody who is awakened in another way. Somebody who has seen something profound, maybe not fully awakened, but seen something profound. Or somebody who has attained some powerful state of meditation. It leaves a trace in the appearance of the person. It leaves something that when you see them, you think, wow, this is astonishing. This is amazing. You look at the person, this shouldn't be possible. I don't know anybody who's like this. You see that there is no, when you observe them, particularly if you observe over a long time, you see there's no anger. In fact, it's just the opposite. There is kindness, there is compassion, there is love, there is peace. There is no desire. The opposite of desire is contentment and generosity. Always willing to give, always willing to teach, always willing to be there for other people. There is this incredible independence, this ability to do your own thing in the world without caring about what anybody else says. The ability to be content with very little, fully happy, fully content, despite living on very, very simple things. The ability to deal with the harshest criticism and problems that the world can throw at you. When you see that, over a long period of time, you think, wow. This is amazing. Nobody is like that. And that is where confidence comes from. That is where this ability to get this inspiration that Ratapala had comes from seeing something like that. And it says elsewhere in the suttas, it says that just seeing somebody who is awakened, just seeing an arahant for the once in your life is a profound blessing, because what you are seeing something that is very rare and very unusual to see in the world, and has a very powerful impact on you when you see such a thing. And that is what Ratapala saw, and that's why he gained this incredible confidence. And when you see that, and then you listen to the teachings of the person, if you see something which is out of this world, quite literally, and then you, of course, you become also very interested in the teachings. And what is this person actually saying? What is it that lies behind this external demeanor, which is so special? And then you take an interest in the teachings, and then the confidence comes also from hearing the teachings that there is a path, there is a way to actually reach that same goal. When you see a person like that, you realize that I too could do with some of those qualities. I too would like to go there, because there's something wonderful and beautiful about this. That is where the confidence arises. Sometimes people are a bit suspicious. How can you actually see these qualities externally in somebody? But it's not that hard to see. It's just like we, in our daily life, we judge other people by externalities. How do you know somebody is angry? Well, you look at them and you see from their speech, from their behavior, from the way they are, you make an inference. There must be something in the mind. There must be anger there. How do you know that somebody is coming from kindness or compassion? Again, you can look at the external behavior. How do you know somebody is slothful, that they are restless, that they have all these qualities? Again, you look at the externals. So the externals is how we actually, in ordinary life, we read people's minds by reading their body language and reading their speech. And it's exactly the same thing we do with anybody in a spiritual sense, whether it's the Buddha or whoever it is. We look at them and then we make a judgment based on those external things. So the point here is that we, in our life, should do exactly what Ratapala did. We shouldn't just have blind faith. And this is why I don't think the word faith is a good translation for sadha. Sadha is this Pali word which I prefer to call confidence, because faith in the English language usually means, okay, I will believe regardless of common sense, or regardless of the evidence, I'm just going to believe. I've decided I'm going to believe in this. But that is not the Buddhist way. The Buddhist way is actually to observe, to make an inference based on your observation, based on your understanding of the situation. That is the right kind of confidence. And only that kind of confidence is worthy of its name. So you should all be doing the same. When you place confidence in a certain teacher, wherever it is, you should watch and you should see what are the qualities of this teacher. Is it somebody who is peaceful? Is it somebody who is kind? Is it somebody who has a pure heart? Or is it somebody who is not so impressive, who is not so wonderful? And when you see the good qualities, not only see them just once, but you see them again and again and again over a long period of time, then that person is worthy of confidence. And that is where you place the confidence. And this is very important. It is very important because so often in spiritual life around the world, you see people placing confidence in faith in the wrong kind of people. And quite literally, if you place the confidence in the wrong kind of person, that is when you get taken for a ride. And people abuse you and they misuse you. And they do all kind of things which are terrible. That's how all these kind of cults develop, and you get cult leaders and you get abuse and all these kind of things. If people had been more Buddhist in their approach, stood back and said, is this person really worthy of this faith and confidence I'm placing in them? If they had taken that approach, there would have been far less problems with cults and abuse around the world than there has. So please take responsibility for your spiritual life. You, everyone here, is responsible for your own spiritual life. It's not about somebody else telling you what to do. You take that responsibility. And the main aspect of that responsibility is to ask yourself, is this path, is this teaching, is this teacher worthy of the confidence that I'm placing in them? And when you take responsibility, you have a power inside of yourself, because you can choose to reject or to accept according to the circumstances. That is the right way to take on board spiritual teachings. So please take responsibility for your own spiritual life. Nobody else is responsible. So that is the first aspect of how to place confidence and where to place confidence and how confidence arises on the Buddhist path. It arises through observation, through inference. It doesn't arise through blind faith. And the second aspect of this confidence that I want to talk about today is the confidence in the actual teachings of the Buddha, the suttas, the things that we call the word of the Buddha. Now, why, how is it that we can take these ancient suttas and actually say that this is the word of the Buddha? Should we have confidence in these ancient texts? How do we know that it has anything to do with what some man said 2,500 years ago who reputedly was very wise? How can we know these things? And this is very important, because once you have some faith and understanding, confidence rather, in these suttas, and then when you read them, they come alive in an entirely new way and they become very powerful for you when you read them and you actually know, or you have a very good grounds for thinking that these came from the source that people are claiming they came from. And the way to do this, to actually find out where the suttas come from, is you actually have to understand a little bit about the history of the text that we call the spiritual texts that belong to the Buddhist heritage. These are vast, enormous texts. Just in the Pali language, which is like the Theravada Buddhism, there is literally hundreds, at least, I can't tell you how many volumes there are, but it's a very, very large number of volumes. Then there is the Chinese Buddhist heritage, which is hundreds of volumes. There is the Tibetan Buddhist heritage, which again is many hundreds of volumes. And then there is Buddhist heritage around the world in different translations and different languages. And all of this, if you're going to read all of this, you, at the end of the day, all you're going to do is spend your whole life reading. And at the end, you're going to be so confused, you have no idea what to do, what to practice, or anything at all. So we need some clarity as to what we should be reading, what we should be focusing on. So how do we get that? Now, one of the first things is to understand that these texts vary enormously. They are not exactly the same. There is enormous variability in these texts. And when you read them, you realize that they couldn't possibly have been spoken by the same person. Some are obviously spoken in a different type of language, using different vocabulary, using a different style, whereas others have a completely different style again. And the classic example which I often like to use is to compare what is often known as the four main Nikayas, and these are like what is usually considered the most authentic word of the Buddha, and compare that with later philosophical teachings known as the Abhidhamma, for example. And when you look, some people will say, oh, the Abhidhamma was taught by the Buddha. But when you read this, and you look at the language in the two, you realize the language is completely different. The vocabulary is completely different. The style is completely different. It doesn't make any sense that this should have been spoken by the same person. It's a bit like taking something like Shakespeare and Dickens and comparing the language between Shakespeare and Dickens, for those of you who have read that. And you know the language is very, very different. It doesn't make any sense to think that those were written or spoken by the same person. And it's exactly the same thing in the Buddha's teachings. And when you look at it like that, you can focus down on a very small part of the Buddha's teaching. There's a small part where the writing is very homogeneous. It is roughly the same across the board. And this is the teaching known in as the four Nikayas of the Pali language, and also the parallel in the Chinese language known as the Agamas. And that is where the language is homogeneous. It is, the ideas are roughly the same. They fit beautifully together. Everything is quite... Everything works out very nicely. And then when you compare that to other Buddhist scriptures, you realize they're actually quite different. So which ones came first? Which ones are likely to be the word of the Buddha and which ones are not? And it is not enough just to think that something is the word of the Buddha just because the text says that this was spoken by the Buddha. That's not enough, because sometimes that is added to the text afterwards. You actually have to use judgment. You have to look at these things carefully. And the way to know, again, you know these things through the evolution of ideas, the evolution of language. It's not very hard to see. You see that language develops in a certain way. And because language and vocabulary and style develops in a certain way, it's quite easy to know what is prior and what comes afterwards. It's even more easy when you look at the philosophical ideas that are developed over time. Because again, philosophical ideas and thought develop over time. Some thought is dependent on earlier thought to exist. A commentary always comes later than the work it comments on. A later philosophical idea that is based on an earlier one must be later than the earlier one, etc., etc. It's quite easy to see how philosophy and language moves and changes over time, as you would expect. Just like when you read Shakespeare, you think, gee, this is sometimes can be quite hard to read because the style is so different. And you realize it must have been written quite a while ago because of the change in style. So when you do that, then it's quite easy to know what are the earliest core teachings. And again, it's very clear that it is the four main Nikayas in the Pali language, and the equivalent suttas in other languages like the Chinese. It's also a little bit more, but that is the main thing. So that is, if anything is the word of the Buddha, that is where it has to be found. And then you can ask yourself another question. Well, how, where, when were these things written? And one of the interesting things to know about these suttas, for example, is that there's quite a lot of historical information in the suttas, because they talk about the kings of the day, they talk about like the political landscape of India, about different countries, about wars and all these kind of things. It's all in there. So because it's all in there, you can actually check these suttas with the real political events that have happened throughout history. And one of the most profound and important political events that happened in the history of India, certainly from a Buddhist point of view, was the King Ashoka, who unified India fully into a massive kingdom about 100 to 150 years after the Buddha. And of course, very interesting that when you read these earliest suttas, there is no mention of King Ashoka in these earlier suttas. You read the later text, then there's lots of things about King Ashoka, because he was a patron of Buddhism, because he was such an important personality in Buddhist history. There's lots about King Ashoka in earlier texts, whole books composed just about King Ashoka, but not in the earliest scriptures. So here you are moving within 100 to 150 years after the Buddha. You're getting very close to the life of the Buddha. In fact, the political situation in India, as is described in the suttas, must be well before the time of Ashoka, because it's quite different from the way it was in Ashoka. It was small kingdoms jostling for influence, jostling for supremacy. At the time of Ashoka, there was one massive kingdom in India, Ashoka's empire, stretching across everything that we know today, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh probably, and all of the Indian subcontinent. So we know that these texts are virtually stemming from the time of the Buddha. But the most powerful evidence of all about these texts is when you start to do things which are known use today as comparative studies, where you compare the Chinese text with the Pali sources. And this is one of the most astonishing things. The Chinese texts, they went their own way soon after the time of the Buddha, about 100, 150 years, maybe 200 years after the Buddha. They went one way, and the Pali texts went another way. They were developed in Sri Lanka, part of the Sri Lankan Buddhist heritage. And the other ones went to the north of India. They separated quite early on. There was something like 3,000 kilometers between these two textual heritages. And what is astonishing is that despite this enormous difference, despite the fact that they were so far apart, and they haven't really met each other for, about 2,200 years, when you compare these suttas, the parallel suttas in Chinese and in Pali today, you find that they are virtually identical after 2,200 years. All the main ideas that you find in these heritages are the same, essentially. What that means is that the heritage, the Buddhist heritage, has been preserved with incredible fidelity for over 2,000 years. Because it has been preserved with such incredible fidelity almost all the way back to the time of the Buddha, it's rational to assume that even that little gap that remains all the way back to the Buddha, it was also preserved with incredible fidelity. So there can be little doubt that the texts that we have today, they are the word of this man known as the Buddha, who existed 2,500 years ago. So when you read the suttas, you're literally reading the word. It's as if the Buddha himself is speaking to you when you read these suttas. So think about that. It's like sitting there and listening to the word of the Buddha himself. Isn't that a wonderful thing? It's like being part of the audience. It's like, I often like to say, when the Buddha was talking 2,500 years ago, he said things in very simple ways so everybody could understand. The Buddha would have known that there would be groups of people like us sitting here today, people reading his suttas after 2,500 years. He would have known that, and he would have expressed his ideas in a way that were understandable for people even long after his demise, after he passed away. So he is, in a very literal sense, actually speaking to us as we are here today. He knew that we would be here listening to his word. So he is actually speaking to us. So when you read the suttas, he is speaking to you in a very literal sense, because he knew this was going to happen. So think about that. Here is this ancient sage who was revered so powerful in India at the time, talking directly to you. How amazing that actually is, and how wonderful that fact basically is. And what is also even more profound is, of course, when you start practicing the Buddhist path and you start to get into meditation practice, you start to attain some deep states of samadhi, your mind becomes peaceful, and your mind starts to unify, it starts to come together. There's not much thinking going on anymore. You have clarity. You have a sense of bliss and peace inside of you. And then you read in the suttas and you see that these things are described in exactly the same way in the suttas as you are experiencing them here and now. Now that connects you with the Buddha directly in a very powerful way. And it's not just that you are reading these things into the suttas, because the way it is described there is actually described from many different angles. The state is described as peaceful, as unified, unification of mind, as one-pointed, as blissful, as peaceful, as tranquil. Not just that, it describes the way you get into these states. It shows you the different stages that you have to go through as you go into them. It explains the process, what you have to do to get into these states. It explains to you how you feel after you get out of these states. And that's all to be read in the suttas. And then you experience these things directly. Now that connects you directly, immediately with the teachings of this man called the Buddha, who existed 2,500 years ago. That is incredibly powerful. And that gives rise to enormous confidence that this man knew something very, very profound. And then when you read the suttas, they really start to come alive in a way that you never would have expected before. And what happens then when these suttas come alive, because you are now you have the confidence that you have seen maybe people today that you find inspiring or have remarkable qualities. So in a sense, you have seen the living tradition of Buddhism. But you have also seen that there is an ancient aspect to the tradition of Buddhism. And this ancient aspect is this heritage that we have inherited from the Buddha from 2,500 years ago. The living tradition and the ancient heritage coming together. That is incredibly powerful. It is very powerful because if you just meet somebody on the street, some kind of guru who seems very wonderful and seems very great, then there's always a sense of uncertainty there. And usually that person will be by himself. He may be the only one who has seen something special. But when somebody is part of a tradition that has been going on for 2,500 years, and people have been experiencing these things for 2,500 years, it makes it very, very strong and very powerful. It's much more than just having a single person who is special. And also it means that you're not actually, it's not that person that you are having as your guru or your cult figure or whatever. It is this whole tradition that you take as your refuge, as something special. And that is much better than having an individual as your kind of guru or cult leader, whatever it is. It's the whole tradition, in particular, the originator and the teachings themselves that came from the Buddha. So that's why the heritage is so important. But at the same time, it is very useful to see that that heritage still is alive today. So when you meet somebody who is special, when you see somebody that has the qualities that are described in this ancient suttas, it brings them alive. And it tells you that these things are still available in the present day and age. So the living tradition, together with the ancient heritage, is one of the most powerful things that makes the Buddhist teaching so unique and so powerful and something which really grabs you when you start reading this. And then, when you then read the suttas, you read them with a sense of confidence in your heart. There's something here, something powerful here, something wonderful. And then, when you read about things that you otherwise might not believe, and these are things like rebirth, for example, there are many people in the world today who cannot really believe in rebirth. They find rebirth is a very difficult thing to believe in. But if you have a confidence that there is something here, if you have seen people who you find are special, you see the Buddha teaching these things, then when you come across the idea of rebirth, you think, I can't just dismiss it anymore. How can I dismiss something which has been spoken by people who are so profound, who have such profound insight, who are so peaceful, who have such apparent high degree of integrity in their life, people who are moral, who are kind? They wouldn't lie. They must have seen something that make them say that there is such thing as rebirth. And then you start to gain a sense of confidence that this thing called rebirth actually is actually real. It actually is something there. It is, at least you have the confidence. You're not certain yet, you're not sure yet, but the confidence starts to arise. And this is how you can have confidence in the idea of rebirth without calling it just blind faith or just placing your faith in something that you have no idea about. And this is very important. It is very important because Buddhism, as far as I'm concerned, without rebirth is not Buddhism at all. There is no such thing as Buddhism without rebirth. Rebirth is one of the foundational things that makes the Buddhist teachings come alive. It's one of the things that actually makes the whole Buddhist spiritual path, that gives it its meaning, that gives us its purpose. And without it, we're not really talking about Buddhism at all. We're talking about something completely different. So have that sense of confidence in those teachings based on what you see, not just based on blind faith. And then when you start to gain this sort of confidence, what happens is very beautiful. It is described in the suttas that somebody who has the right kind of confidence, when you reflect on the Buddha's teachings, you feel inspired. You feel something awakens inside of you. And when you do that reflection, you feel inspired. The hindrances, the bad states of mind, they start to decline. And what you have instead, you have joy and inspiration. And it is based on that joy and inspiration that comes just through reflecting on the Dhamma through confidence. That then gives rise to the mindfulness, which in turn gives rise to the deep states of meditation. And the whole path comes along. It happens all by itself because of that confidence which is there at the root. So don't dismiss that confidence. The Buddhist teaching is there's a balance here. Of course, we're talking about confidence on the one hand, not blind faith, which is good. So we have a sense of investigation, of observation. So we try to find this balance, not being too cynical, observing too much, being too judgmental, but also not having this kind of blind faith. And we find that balance between the blind faith and the cynicism, where we observe and we place confidence where it is worthy, then that is where we find the right balance. And then the joy happens, the mindfulness happens, and the path really starts to take off. And that is why confidence is called one of the five spiritual faculties. It is a faculty in the sense that it is a force, it is a strength, it is a power inside of you. When you have that confidence, it is a power because it helps you along the path. It pushes you along. It empowers your meditation. It empowers your ability to do the spiritual practice, whatever stage you're at. And that's why it's called a faculty. So build it up. Don't be afraid of this. And try to understand why and where that confidence comes from and how it is built up. And then it will have a powerful and long-lasting effect on your spiritual practice and your spiritual life. So, that is all I want to say this evening. Does anybody want to ask any questions or maybe add something or complain about some of the things I have said? You have the right to complain if you like. Does anybody want to say anything here? Over there, should we have a microphone here? You have to speak in the microphone, apparently, so it's coming your way here.
You said that confidence is one of the five spiritual faculties. Mm. So can you tell me what the other four are, please?
Okay. So the first faculty, and the first one is the most important one, because the first one is like the basis for the other one. So the first one is confidence, saddha in Pali. The second one is energy. And again, you can see how this works. Once you have the saddha, once you have the faith, you actually feel inspired. And inspiration is like energy, right? When you feel inspired, you want to do things. You want to get out. You want to get going on the path. So faith gives rise to energy. When you have that energy, the mind also becomes clear. So the next one is the mindfulness. So from faith, you get energy, you get mindfulness. What is that mindfulness? That mindfulness is basically the ability to have a mind that is present right here and now, but not too much thinking going on, and you just have a sense of clarity inside of you. That is the mindfulness. And from mindfulness, meditation takes off. And this is one of the things I think people often misunderstand, is that before you have mindfulness, it's very hard to meditate. In fact, you can't really meditate. First, you have to have the clarity of the mind, where the mind is peaceful, clear, you are present, and then meditation can happen. So the fourth factor is samadhi, meditation, deep meditation. Because when you have mindfulness, you have a sense of control of the mind. You can focus on the object. Because you can focus on the object, the breath or whatever it is, then meditation becomes possible, the mind unifies, and you know, all these things happen. And then the last factor is wisdom, panya in Pali. So from the samadhi, from the meditation, comes panya. Only when you have a deep meditation or samadhi does true wisdom arise. So this is how there is five spiritual faculties, and how they lead step by step, one after the other. The first one leads to the second one, all the way to the fifth one. And that's why the confidence is so important, because it actually is the first stage on the path that leads to all the other ones. And you can also actually see this other places as well in the suttas. The whole gradual training, the whole practice of the Buddha spiritual path always starts off with confidence, with faith. Confidence, that's where it always begins. Without that, it doesn't even start. That's how it takes off. And that's why people do practice the Buddha's teachings. You happy with that answer? Yeah? Okay. Just come, take your next, Chris. There's one more down there, first of all. Yeah.
You spoke about the suttas. Is this a book, and where could we read it?
Okay, that's a good question. So, one of the problems with a crowd like this is that some people know a lot about Buddhism, and some are beginners. So sometimes you say things which some people don't understand, and other people start yawning. So, but the suttas are, there's a collection of four groups of suttas. One is called the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, one is called the long sayings of the Buddha, one is called the connected sayings of the Buddha, one is called the numerical sayings of the Buddha. And these are available in the library here at Dhammaloka. You can borrow it from the library. You can also, I believe, purchase those if you want to have your own copy. And a good place to start, there's actually a collection which is an anthology, which brings together all the most important suttas into one book. So you don't actually have to buy the individual ones. That is called In the Buddha's Words. In the Buddha's Words, or is it In the Words of the Buddha? One of those. And it is a, again, I think we have it in the library, both for borrowing and also for sale. And that gives you, it's very nice because it is introduced by somebody who is a very good expert in Buddhism. He's one, I consider him one of my teachers because I read all the things that he had written when I started out. His name is Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's one of the most famous translators of Pali Suttas. And he has made this anthology. And in there, there's lots of explanation about how to understand the suttas, lots of notes at the end that explains the difficult terms and all these kind of things. So that's in the Buddha's words, I think. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that's available. So that's what I would recommend you to start off with. Yeah. There's also teachings online. You can just search probably for the word of the Buddha online as well, if you prefer that. Okay, Chris.
Just picking up from what you said just before, the implication is that those things are causal, they're building. Okay, so faith, what you're saying is that faith comes first, and then energy, and then mindfulness, and concentration, and wisdom. Am I understanding you correct? They're causal. One leads to the other, leads to the other, leads to the other. Is that correct?
Mm.
So if you assume that, what you're saying then is that if you've got lousy concentration, if you've got a monkey mind, if you've got a scrambled brain, okay, that by definition means that your mindfulness is all over the place. And a lot of times I myself, and I know many of my friends here, coming to this place, and their brains are really scattered all over the place, and we sit down and we try and meditate, okay? But really what you're saying is, the implications of what you're saying is, don't do this thing where you just keep on bringing yourself back to that point, because the causal conditions for concentration are not yanking your mind and your attention back onto the breath, but the causal conditions for the mind staying on the breath and getting good samadhi are energy and faith. So are you saying that in many ways, sometimes when we're all sitting here trying to meditate, we're flogging a dead horse, as it were, that we should be doing something else that rouses up either faith or rouses up energy. We should be jumping up and down and getting a bit of energy going, or doing some chanting or something like that to then create the causal conditions for good mindfulness and concentration.
It's not just any kind of energy. It's not just about jumping up and down. It's the right kind of energy. It's a still kind of energy, a peaceful kind of energy, right? So it's the energy that comes from, as you say, faith or confidence. I don't think the word faith is right. It comes from confidence. A sense that there's something here, something profound, beautiful here. And that, you know, gives sense to joy. The joy has energy with it. And that then leads on to the mindfulness. But it's not just faith that leads to mindfulness. The other aspect that leads to mindfulness is virtue, is goodness, is morality. Morality has exactly the same effect as faith. So you, or confidence. So you work with both confidence and morality together. And morality has exactly the same effect. So if you are a very moral person, and when I mean moral, I don't just mean by speech and body, I also mean by mind. And that is why where the metta comes in and the compassion and the kindness comes in, because your mind is actually being moral. You are thinking in a moral way. You're changing your mind around. A mind that is moral is by nature has mindfulness in it. And this is what you find in the suttas again and again, is that sila or virtue is the foundation for mindfulness. Mindfulness comes from virtue. Confidence is another aspect which can be used in exactly the same way. But virtue and morality is probably even more important. Without that, you're not going to get anywhere. So these two things come together. So, you know, gain the confidence by reading the suttas, by doing whatever you do, listening to the talks to inspire you. Sometimes it can be just be listening to the right talk can be so inspiring. I found that in my life. You listen to the right talk at the right time, you feel so inspired. And that purifies you. You feel pure afterwards. You feel energetic afterwards. You want to meditate afterwards. All these things come together. I've seen that so many times I'm mostly familiar with monastic life now, but other monks who after a talk, good talk, they just want to sit there and just keep meditating because they feel so incredibly inspired and peaceful. So all of these things, wherever the inspiration comes from, is the right place. But certainly, it's not just that. It's the virtue is very, very important. And that's why for many people, if you find meditation hard, and as you're saying, you're flogging a dead horse sometimes, then do some metta instead. Try to change your perception of things, understand things in a new way. Do forgiveness, you know, let go of things from the past. One of the problems is that if you don't have metta, if you don't have enough metta, don't have enough kindness towards others, we tend to harbor things in our heart which, you know, blocks us from gaining the mindfulness. Anything you have in your heart, any kind of grudge about the past or problem about the past, that is going to block the mindfulness because the mind will have a tendency to go there. So that is where the metta and the forgiveness and the compassion, the understanding comes in. You can let go of these things. Well, that is a change in perspective, a change in doing things in a new way, looking at things in a new light. How can I look at this situation differently? How can I understand a person that is so hard and difficult? How can I have compassion and kindness towards somebody who is difficult in my life? And if you really try, you will find ways of doing that. And that is how you develop the metta as well. It's great to do metta formally by sitting down and wishing all beings well. But sometimes you have to do your homework and actually, you know, think about these things. How can I actually look at these beings with a mind of kindness and compassion and understanding? Yeah. Am I answering your question? Yeah? Okay. Very good. Eddie, you need a microphone, I think.
Ajahn Brahmali? Yeah. Don't you think the Buddha was also full of confidence in his teaching, as his teaching was based on his own experience?
Sure.
Yeah, remember he spent 6 long years, you know, to gain that enlightenment, and he taught for 45 years. Yeah. And also during his teaching, he constantly reminded people, you know, ehi pasiko, come and see, come and experience, you know, come and investigate, you know. And he was saying, don't believe what people say, okay? Investigate, okay? And when you find it conducive, that it makes sense to you, then you accept it. That is very, how to say, inspiring. Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. Any questions or is that just a comment? Comment? Yeah. Okay. Good. Anybody else have a question? Everybody happy? I've got some questions on the screen here from various places. One is from, first one here is from a fellow called Michael. From Dundee in Scotland. And how he asks, how do we know that the person is enlightened and place confidence in him? I have seen the Dalai Lama. Is he enlightened? Okay, well, you don't know whether somebody is enlightened. That's the basic reality. All you can do is judge somebody's external appearance. And when you see something inspiring and you know that there must be something there, you don't know exactly what it is, but you know that there's something beautiful there, something that you also could do within your life, something wonderfully kind, something wonderfully soft, something wonderfully compassionate, no anger, no irritation, something incredibly peaceful, something that can deal with the world in a way most people can never deal with it. So you just look at the externals, and when you see externals like that, you realize there must be something inside which is very different from your mind or my mind or most people's minds. And that's when you think, yeah, there's something here, something powerful here. You may not know whether the person is enlightened or not, but you know there's something there. And that's where you start off. So you place some confidence in that person, and then you can take those teachings on board because of that confidence. And then over time, as you practice more, as you gain more experience, you continue to observe. You never stop observing. And then over time, you find that your understanding of confidence, where you have confidence, who you have confidence in, what confidence means, all these things will also change slightly over time. And it will become more wise, that confidence, as time goes, because your understanding improves. So it's not a one-time, this is confidence, that's the end of it. It's a continuous process of regenerating that confidence and improving it and making it more profound, making it more realistic, making it, and all these kind of things. Is the Dalai Lama enlightened? I think, you know, you can never ask somebody else whether somebody is enlightened. That's the wrong way of going around it. You have to observe for yourself. That's your job to find out whether he's enlightened. It's not my job to tell you. If I told you, would you believe me that he is enlightened? And if you did, that would be the wrong way to go about it. You have to look for yourself. Is he worthy of that confidence? If you think so, then you follow him. If you don't think so, well, then maybe keep looking. And that is the other aspect. There is another thing as well, which I forgot to mention in my talk just now, and that is that it's not just the other person, the enlightened person, but it's also you yourself. You have to have certain qualities to be able to see whether somebody else has profound qualities. So it's the two coming together. So somebody like Ratapala, who was very determined to become a monk, the reason why he was able to be so determined was because of his own personal qualities. Where did they come from? What was the personal qualities of Ratapala? And where they come from is likely that he has had some experience before, maybe a sense of peace or profound metta or compassion, something inside of himself. And when he saw the Buddha, he recognized that same state in the Buddha, just even more profound, even beyond what he himself had. So he has some experience, and then you recognize that experience in somebody else. Or it could be something maybe from a past life, whereby you have met somebody like that in a past life, and in this life you recognize it. You think, yeah, I've seen this before somewhere. It's a kind of deja vu experience. You don't really know where it comes from, but there's something here which is amazing. Yeah. So that's why it is like two things coming together. The person and the person who is seeking, and the person who can teach, coming together at the right time. And those two qualities coming together powerfully, that's when you have people becoming arahants and practicing the path fully to the highest ability. Anyway, the second person here is Alex from Sydney, and he asks, or maybe she, I'm not sure, how do people deal with a loss of faith in a certain teacher or teaching? Okay, well, basically, how you deal with that is to understand that the Buddhist teaching is much more than an individual. Individuals can always go wrong. And that is why it is so important not to place too much faith in just one single person, because that person may turn out to be wrong, and that person may turn out to be corrupt or to have lots of defilements. And later on, when you see that, you become so disillusioned. And I know this has happened to so many people who consider themselves Buddhists. They placed all their faith in one person. And because that person later on turned out to be no good, basically, they felt so heartbroken and they felt so terrible because of that. So be careful. Buddhism is not guru worship. It's not worship of individuals. Buddhism is about this big thing, this big stream, and it comes from the suttas of the Buddha. It goes back 2,500 years. That is where, at the end of the day, you have to place your confidence in that big thing we call Buddhism, not in any one individual. And when you do that, then whether an individual turns out to be corrupt or defiled or do all kind of crazy things, then you can deal with it because your faith is rooted in something more profound. And it's also the same with Buddhism itself. Sometimes our understanding of what Buddhism is evolves over time, and that's fine. That's perfectly okay. Gradually you may shift your faith and confidence from some teachings to other teachings. For example, when you realize that the Abhidhamma perhaps wasn't spoken by the Buddha, then you don't read so much Abhidhamma anymore, and you read instead the suttas. So you change your focus. And that is good. That is what investigation is all about. So don't be afraid of investigating. Just make sure that you place your faith in the right place, and then that will carry you forward. If you don't do that, if you don't keep investigating, that is when you are in really dangerous territory. The fact that maybe that loss of faith has happened for you in the first place probably means that you place too much faith in an individual in the first place. So maybe what you should learn from this is to understand that it's not about individuals. It's about the big picture. And when you understand that, then that can carry you forward. And you can, okay, you lost something, but you have gained something much greater in the process because you have learned something. You've understood something important. So that is maybe one way of dealing with that loss. I hope that helps. Then the last question is from Timothy Lim in Brisbane. What if you don't have strong confidence, faith in any teaching? Doubt, questioning seems to be prevailing concept in the modern world. That is true. And that is why it is so useful to sometimes find a teacher who you have confidence in. You look at somebody and be independent. Don't just follow the herd, the crowd, and do whatever everybody else does. When you really see somebody who is worthy of confidence, then don't be afraid of having that confidence. Don't think that if other people talk that person down and then you have to follow what they say. Have enough personal strength to do things that you think are right. So when you see something beautiful, then that is where you have confidence. And then when that beauty in the particular person that you see in the present day matches with what you read in the suttas, then that is grounds for confidence indeed. So that is really the thing. Of course, it is hard. It is not often that you come across a teacher who is special, who is unique, who has all these good qualities. In fact, it is quite rare. So when you do see something special, then value that, treasure that, and don't throw it away easily, and allow your confidence to grow on that basis, and it becomes something beautiful. But there is no, in the end, there is no final trick. You start practicing the path. Many people will find that even if they haven't got much strong confidence, they still, by reading the suttas, you will find there's lots of useful advice there, beautiful things. And when you start to put those into practice in your daily life, you will see that they work. And that in itself will give a boost of confidence, and it will carry you along. And gradually, gradually, stage by stage, things start to build up, and the whole path starts to come together. Okay, so any last questions? No, very good. Okay, so let us pay our respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Mm-hmm.